Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Crude oil rose a dollar and change today to close over 75 bucks, 75.08 to be precise. And as you ponder your next airplane flight, consider this. At those prices, how many gallons of jet fuel can an airline get for its money? Southwest said today, not as many as it used to. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, representing America's public transportation industry, delivering 10 billion riders annually, and working for an energy-independent America. PublicTransportation.org. And by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today, everybody, the 4th of September. Great to have you with us. For years, Southwest Airlines has been the fair-haired boy of the aviation industry. It weathered the airline storm the past couple of years in pretty good shape with steady profits and decent passenger loans, and it spawned a bunch of imitation low-cost carriers. Over the holiday weekend, Southwest led the way in another area, too. Airfares went up in a lot of cities around the country, and educated guessers out there might have already figured out that analysts are blaming the high cost of jet fuel. Southwest, in particular, has been watching its fuel costs rise, so fares are going up on its longer flights by $10 each way and a couple of bucks on shorter flights. And Marketplace's Bob Moon tells us the competition is only too happy to go along for the ride.
Not long ago, whenever the big airlines tried to hike ticket prices, something kept tugging those fares right back down again. In many cities, that something was Southwest Airlines. Its low fares would usually frustrate any attempt by rivals to make a fare increase stick. Now, Southwest is feeling some pricing pressure of its own, and in a variation on its advertising slogan,
"You are now free to move about the country."
Southwest is essentially sending the message, "You are now free to move up your fares." Industry consultant Michael Boyd cites one case in point.
When Southwest raises fares in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, there's about six other places around there where Delta can raise fares as well.
Indeed, no sooner had Southwest made its move than American, United, Northwest, and U.S. Airways all confirmed they would match it. Boyd says Southwest had successfully hedged against higher fuel costs with contracts that locked in lower prices. But now that those are expiring, it's having to pay as much as its rivals.
Remember, Southwest has had the advantage of lower fuel costs, which they've passed on to the consumer. Now they've got to take a little of it back as fuel goes up.
That doesn't necessarily mean fares will keep rising as fuel costs do. At CRA International, airline analyst Mark Kiefer says there's still plenty of competition from newly emerging low-cost carriers.
They now compete with the legacy carriers in at least 70% of the markets in the U.S., and as a result, they determine what the fares will be in a very real sense.
Kiefer says the low-cost rivals could even force Southwest to avoid raising prices too much. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
This being the first work day of the month, Detroit reported sales today. Ford, down. Newly private Chrysler, down. Toyota, down. General Motors, up. Although you have to take that with a grain of salt, the company said part of its 5% rise in sales last month was due to steep discounts on some of its pickup trucks. Tomorrow in Washington, a Senate subcommittee will begin looking into mine safety. The focus will be the disaster nearly a month ago at the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah. Critics say mining companies are sacrificing safety to get every last lump of coal out of the ground. But Jeremy Hobson reports demand for coal is up and so are prices, so companies have more incentive than ever to mine every inch they can.
The price of coal has more than doubled in the last 6 years, and demand is soaring. Luke Popovich at the National Mining Association says it's no wonder mining companies are trying to maximize output.
Why leave that coal in the ground? Why leave any resource that's valuable in the ground at a time when the demand for electricity generation fired by coal is at an all-time high?
that's pushing miners deeper underground, and in some cases, they're going after the very pillars of coal that hold a mine ceiling. Sometimes, says Phil Smith at the United Mine Workers of America, workers are put at risk to increase profits.
Coal operators have always wanted to make more money, and they're willing to bend just about any rule that they can.
Luke Popovich of the National Mining Association disagrees. He says mining companies don't put profits before safety.
Certainly, if they found that a type of mining practice would have endangered the lives of their workers, they wouldn't do it.
Congress will be looking at that very question tomorrow. Among the witnesses expected at a Senate hearing, the owner of the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah. Six men were trapped inside that mine in an accident last month. It's not clear whether they were going after the pillars of coal holding up the ceiling of their mine. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
It may seem as if Microsoft has already taken over the world, but today the software maker took a hit from a computing group in Geneva, Switzerland. Its members declined to designate a key Microsoft product as an international standard. And Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from the European desk in London, it's a decision that could cost the company millions.
Microsoft has suffered an embarrassing rebuff. The company has tried for 2 years to win the prized ISO label for its Office file format. ISO stands for International Organization for Standardization. When applied to software, the label certifies that this is an open system that will always be available. And that, says Maya Palmer of the Financial Times, is especially important for some of Microsoft's biggest customers, governments.
They don't want to be dependent solely on one company like Microsoft to be able to access their, you know, citizens' records in the future. So they would like to use software that will be open, accessible, usable in the future.
She says that for Microsoft, a big chunk of business could be in jeopardy.
Microsoft is obviously worried that if it doesn't get the ISO certification, then it will lose government orders.
Office could in time lose its dominant market share, but the company failed to win the ISO label because of continuing concerns about openness, says technology writer Barry Fox.
In theory, Microsoft is making the format for Word much more open. The question is, how open is open? And that is what critics are raising.
Companies applying to the ISO usually file no more than 1,000 pages of technical details. Microsoft filed more than 6,000, which some critics described as incomprehensible. Microsoft has until next February to convince the doubters. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Traders evidently enjoyed their three-day weekend. People were in a buying mood on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Jeffrey Lacker is probably not a name too many of you out there know unless you follow the Federal Reserve pretty closely. Lacker's the president of the Richmond Fed. He's also a member of the Federal Open Market Committee. That's the group that sets the Fed's main interest rate, the federal funds rate. Anyway, Lacker said today he's not entirely convinced that rate needs to be lowered, which sets up a whole lot of people on Wall Street to be disappointed when the FOMC meets to talk about interest rates on September the 18th. The Fed did do something today that could matter to a different group, though. The central bank asked mortgage lenders and loan companies to find a way to ease up on subprime borrowers, people who might be facing foreclosure. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli is here with more. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Kai.
So the Fed came out with these guidelines today about help for borrowers, and I use that word intentionally. These are guidelines. It's not an order or a regulation. What are we looking at in terms of help now in the subprime crisis for homeowners?
Well, there's a bit more than guidelines for now, and there's a reason given for why we're not seeing more than that, but let's look at what we have seen. Last Friday, President Bush announced a plan to help 80,000 distressed homeowners refinance their mortgages. Congressional Democrats point to the much larger number in trouble and say that's not enough. And we're also hearing of a Senate bill coming up this month that supposedly will set aside $100 million. That money is for nonprofit groups to use to help homeowners find refinancing for their mortgages. That's what we know is in the pipeline so far.
Sounds a little bit, though, like baby steps. You've got 80,000 people being helped by the president's initiative, but there are something like 3 million adjustable rate mortgages due to reset in the coming year. $100 million somehow doesn't seem like a whole lot of money. What's with the incrementalism here?
Well, Kai, the problem is that all sides and all political stripes have to walk a fine line here. They want to target help to the many people who were duped or scammed into bad mortgages. On the other hand, lawmakers and regulators don't want to bail out speculators and dicey loan companies because it just encourages them to keep doing the risky things that got the whole financial system into trouble in the future. So it's going to take some time to figure out how to target help to the right people. And, of course, the problem there is that some of the folks who deserve help don't have much time.
What can we expect, do you think, with the inevitable congressional hearings on this? Who's going to be in the hot seat, and what kind of questions are they going to face?
Well, there is a special hot seat reserved for the ratings agencies, the folks on Wall Street, who were telling all of us for a long time that these packages of subprime mortgages that were packaged as investment securities were great investments and safe investments. And, of course, neither of those turned out to be true. And Congress wants to know, and we know for a fact that they're going to be asking these questions, why those ratings agencies blew their ratings on the risk of these investment packages. And also they want to talk quite a bit about conflicts of interest that Congress perceives in the fact that these ratings agencies are paid by the very people they rate. So there's going to be a seat at the table for those agencies for sure.
What about some of the subprime lenders and the lengths that they went to make these loans and people to whom they were offering? Are they going to have to answer any questions?
Well, there's been an increasing, you can't even call it a trickle anymore, there's been a steady drumbeat of stories about the tactics that were used by these subprime lenders to get people into loans, and the tactics were at the very least duplicitous and in many cases, I'm sure, will be proven to be illegal, and they will also be shown to be steering people into loans that were inferior to the loans that very same borrower could have received, more expensive loans than the borrower qualified for. So those folks are going to have a place at the table, too. Of course, one of the problems there is that a good number of those lenders are out of business or on the verge of it, so I'm not sure who gets to come to the table there, but you'll be seeing subprime lenders at the table as well, for sure.
Marketplace's Steve Tripoli. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome, Kai.
Fashion Week kicks off tomorrow in New York City. The latest looks for next spring will be on display, as will hundreds of women showing off those looks. Many of the models will be from the Elite Modeling Agency, the firm associated with the likes of Claudia Schiffer and Gisele Bündchen. Elite opened its doors in Paris 34 years ago, catering to the tastes of the time. But Paris today is a different place. The city and its suburbs especially have become more diverse, with residents of North African descent making up one of the largest minorities. And recently, Elite has been dipping into those neighborhoods to recruit new talent. John Lawrenson reports.
Nawal, a very beautiful 19-year-old of Algerian origin, stands in the queue, her number pinned to her chest, waiting for her chance to walk as modelishly as she can down an improvised catwalk in front of the judges from Elite Modeling Agency. Rosny-sous-Bois, in the heart of the riot-hit Paris suburbs, is an unlikely place to come in search of beauty and an equally unlikely place to come in search of opportunity. But for Nawal and around 200 other young women who've come here today, this is her big chance.
I've always been fascinated by the fashion world, so I decided to try my luck today. It's not so easy for girls with a Muslim background. Some of my family said I shouldn't even think about modeling. But it's my life, and I intend to live it the way I want.
3 others ahead of Nawal have just made it through to the next round. Elodie is 15. Her parents moved here from Ivory Coast. She dreams of a success that would change the face of French fashion.
It would be great to see myself and one of my African sisters in the fashion magazines. Girls can be pretty wherever they come from. Right now, you don't see any girls like me.
To find out why there are so few African origin models in the fashion magazines, I go where the hopefuls in Rosny-sous-Bois dream of ending up, 8 miles and a whole world away, to one of the fashion shows in the catacombs beneath the Louvre Museum.
You made it!
After the show, I get backstage. I ask Carotte, Marie Claire magazine's casting director, when she uses black models.
There's always got to be a reason to put a black girl in a shoot. And generally, the poor things, it's something like a safari theme. We'll take the model off for a shoot in Africa so she can be in her element, as it were. But there really isn't much demand.
But does it matter what happens in the small and superficial world of fashion? Isn't the success of one black entrepreneur or one Algerian origin politician worth scores of Naomi Campbell's? The sociologist and Sorbonne professor Eric Massé organized a seminar on the media representation of ethnic minorities earlier this year. He believes upping visibility counts because it shows the way forward.
They are in France, they are French, they belong to France. And if they are more visible in TV program or advertisement, maybe the fact that there is no non-white people among the parliament will appear more scandalous.
But getting minorities into commercials is difficult. For Mr. Massé, the advertising industry sees one thing when it sees a non-European origin face: commercial risk. So back out in the burbs, isn't Elite getting young women's hopes up for nothing? Elite's president, Gérald Marie, tells a North African girl to come back and see them when she's lost a few pounds. But if she does, and she gets onto Elite's books, would a French luxury brand ever choose her for one of their ads?
We have to really be ready to propose to the companies the possibility to choose beautiful kids in the new generations coming from the different ethnic.
Three more aspiring models pre-selected, relieved and elated. But this evening there's another elimination, and there are three more in the coming months. And if Elite wants them, will the market? They still have a long way to go. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Coming up, study hard, get good grades, and your grandchildren might thank you later.
Once a first-generation college student gets their degree, the likelihood that everyone in their lineage gets a degree increases exponentially.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it's anybody's guess what helped the markets today. Maybe you just check that box that says all of the above. The Dow Industrials gained 91 points, 0.2%, to end at 13,448. The Nasdaq bounced up 33 points, 1.3%, to finish at 2630. The S&P 500 scooped up 15 points, 1% there, to close at 1489. Apple gained 4% after an analyst said sales of its PCs and iPhones are probably exceeding his earlier estimates. Apple may be introducing some revamped and fancy iPods this week. Yahoo piped up 5.5%. Bear Stearns named Yahoo a top pick on what it says are high chances the giant web gateway will be bought. Look out for that one. That has lead story written all over it. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.55%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America. Through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com. And by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve Board releases its latest Beige Book survey of regional economic conditions. The Senate Special Aging Committee discusses qualifications for those advising seniors about their money. And seminars get underway at the World Nuclear Association's annual symposium in London. Program topics include global fuel market supply and demand and nuclear power applications beyond electricity production. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and
write myself a letter.
A couple of $100 in new supplies and back-to-school clothes later, some of you might be having a bit of buyer's remorse right about now. It's a feeling our commentator Sandra Tsing Lo knows all too well. She spent more than $1,300 for a Picasso lithograph the other day and later lamented the purchase of such a pricey copy. Artist Nick Patton of Hudson, New York, wrote in with a correction for us. A copy can be a lithograph, he said, but a lithograph is not always a copy.
Lithography is an original printmaking medium where you draw on a limestone block or an aluminum plate that is later inked and printed in addition.
More arts now, the literary kind this time. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke with the author of a biography of winemaker Robert Mondavi. We talked about the moment when Mondavi and his brother Peter came to blows. Robert was pushed out of the family business and went on to start his own winery, arguably a turning point in the history of the American wine industry. Jeffrey Danaher of Cincinnati, Ohio, thinks it might have been interesting if we had shared the actual cause of that brawl.
The fist fight had to do with tension between Robert and Peter over the purchase of a mink coat at a time when their business was struggling.
With crude oil near $75 a barrel, struggling's not a word you might use to describe the Venezuelan oil industry. President Hugo Chavez is using the proceeds to distribute foreign aid across Latin America, and a whole lot of it, too, almost $9 billion worth. An economist in our story about that topic said that in doing so, Chavez might be giving people fish instead of teaching them how to fish. Listener and former poverty activist David Quammen points out the saying kind of misses the point.
That is the greatest half-truth ever told. If the man has nothing to fish with, nor a place to fish, all the knowledge in the world will not produce the next day's catch.
Finally, Leona Helmsley's dog. The hotel magnate left $12 million to her pet when she died a couple of weeks ago. Helmsley called her millions a living, which reminded John DeCherney of Juneau, Alaska, of an old joke he knows.
So this old man is crossing the street, and he gets hit by a car. A policeman comes up, wraps his coat around him, calls an ambulance, looks down at the old man and says, "Are you comfortable?" And he looks up and goes, "I make a living."
But bum. If you hear anything on the program you'd care to comment on, our homepage is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. It's technically still summer, but the vacation is over for almost everyone of school age in this country, K through 12 and beyond. More people from almost every background go to college today than did so 30 years ago. But if you're thinking ivy-covered halls, think again. From North Carolina Public Radio, Laura Leslie reports some students may be learning to dream small.
It's lunchtime at Chapel Hill High School, one of the most academically competitive schools in North Carolina. It's a good school by any measure, but it's also an easy place for at-risk kids to get lost. That's why counselors here started the Blue Ribbon program, to help push those students through high school and into college. Most of the students in the program are minority kids from low-income families, like Alicia Lee. Alicia's a senior this fall, and she already knows she's going. She says her mother has made that clear.
You're going to college no matter what. If I have to put you down in there myself, I mean, it's one of those things. It's like I've always known I was going to, like, get more or less good grades and go to college and get into a good college. I said, no, which good college?
North Carolina Central is at the top of her list because that's where her mother earned her two-year degree. That alone gives Alicia a head start, according to researcher Danette Gerald with the Education Trust in Washington, D.C.
Once a first-generation college student gets their degree, the likelihood that everyone in their lineage gets a degree increases exponentially.
But even with that advantage, Alicia and other low-income students still face one big barrier to college, the cost. It's more than tripled over the past 25 years. State and federal aid hasn't kept up. And Gerald says many schools are using their money differently, too. Instead of focusing on need-based aid, they're using their grants to attract high-performing students to boost their college rankings.
Even if that student has the money to pay for college, they'll woo that student with aid money to get them to go to their institution.
That doesn't mean there's no money for low-income students, but need-based financial aid is more likely these days to be a loan than a grant. That's a problem, according to Greg Meyer with the Blue Ribbon Program. He says many low-income families just won't take loans.
They don't have the same perspective that middle-class families have about student loan debt being a good investment, an investment in yourself. Debt has always been bad to them.
Meyer says a lot of these families also suffer from sticker shock, and many don't understand that the sticker price is negotiable. In North Carolina, tuition, room, and board at a four-year public university averages about $10,000 a year. Low-income students almost never pay that much, Meyer says, but it can still make a bachelor's degree seem out of reach.
And that would be another reason why a two-year program would be more attractive to them. What if I can get out for $12,000 versus $40,000? It's so much better.
That's what Simone Ratcliffe is thinking. At 17, she's stylish, self-possessed, and smart. She has one of the highest GPAs in her class. Meyer says Simone could easily go to a four-year college, but she isn't sure she wants to.
What I've been hearing from people is, like, if you go to a two-year college, you can basically get the same out of it as a four-year.
Simone's older sister is the only member of her family to go to college so far. She's in community college training to become a pharmacy tech. Simone's thinking about doing the same.
My cousin, she was telling me about a man who did it and how he makes like $20 an hour and stuff, and he works in like a little warehouse making medicine and stuff. So it's like that's what a lot of people need.
After Simone heads back to class, Greg Meyer weighs in.
$20 an hour seems like a lot to her, and it's $40,000 a year, and that is a lot to her. But she probably doesn't realize how little $40,000 a year is in the grand scheme of things. And that whole piece that she said about, well, if you go to a two-year program or a four-year program, it's about the same. Anybody who's been through a four-year college knows that's not true. But for some reason, that's a very real perception to her.
For students like Simone, Meyer says, it comes down to a simple choice between prospering later or paying the rent sooner. He's worried that higher education is turning into a two-tiered system, one for big dreams and one for small. In Chapel Hill, I'm Laura Leslie for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, Steve Tripoli told us earlier about how the government is trying to buffer consumer pocketbooks against subprime foreclosures. Well, thankfully, there's somebody else out there trying to help the average Joe. Kinda. We read in the Boston Globe today that credit card offers to subprime mortgage holders jumped 41% in the first half of the year. For those keeping score, during the same time frame, nearly one in five subprime mortgages were more than 60 days past due. The data comes from the market research firm Mintel International. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 91 points, two-thirds of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 33 points. It's about 1.3%. The S&P 500 up 15 points. 1% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornone, Eric Johnson, and Aaron Scott engineer for us. Coming up next time, renters feel the pinch in Vatican City.
Before they were maybe too tolerant, and now they are going to turn the screw, and I'm cut in the middle.
And I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.